I'm extremely excited to announce a brand new sponsor for the Behind the Shield podcast, that is Transcend. Now, for many of you listening, you are probably working the same brutal shifts that I did for 14 years, suffering from sleep deprivation, body composition challenges, mental health challenges, libido, hair loss, etc. Now, when it comes to the world of hormone replacement and peptide therapy, what I have seen is a shift from doctors telling us that we were within normal limits, which was definitely incorrect, all the way to the other way now, where men's clinics are popping up left, right, and center. So I myself wanted to find a reputable company that would do an analysis of my physiology and then offer supplementations without ramming, for example, hormone replacement therapy down my throat. Now, I came across Transcend because they have an altruistic arm, and they were a big reason why the 7X project I was a part of was able to proceed because of their generous donations. They also have the Transcend Foundations, where they're actually putting military and first responders through some of their therapies at no cost to the individual. So my own personal journey so far, filled in the online form, went to Quest, got blood drawn, and a few days later, I'm talking to one of their wellness professionals as they guide me through my results and the supplementation that they suggest. In my case specifically, because I transitioned out the fire service 5 years ago and been very diligent with my health, my testosterone was actually in a good place. So I went down the peptide route and some other supplements to try and maximize my physiology, knowing full well the damage that 14 years of shift work has done. Now, I also want to underline, because I think this is very important, that each of the therapies they offer, they will talk about the pros and cons. So for example, a lot of first responders in shift work, our testosterone will be low, but sometimes nutrition, exercise, and sleep can offset that on its own. So this company is not going to try and push you down a path, especially if it's one that you can't come back from. So whether it's libido, brain fog, inflammation, gut health, performance, sleep, this is definitely one of the most powerful tools in the toolbox. So to learn more, go to transcendcompany.com or listen to episode 808 of the Behind the Shield podcast with founder Ernie Colling. This episode is sponsored by a company I've used for well over a decade, and that is 5-11. I wore their uniforms back in Anaheim, California, and have used their products ever since. From their incredibly strong yet light footwear to their cut uniforms for both male and female responders, I found them hands down the best workwear in all the departments that I've worked for. Outside of the fire service, I use their luggage for everything and I travel a lot, and they are also now sponsoring the 7X team as we embark around the world on the Human Performance Project. We have MRF coming up in May, and again, I bought their plate carrier. I ended up buying real ballistic plates rather than the fake weight plates, and that has been my ride or die through MRF the last few years as well. But one area I want to talk about that I haven't in previous sponsorship spots is their brick and mortar element. They were predominantly an online company up till more recently, but now they are approaching 100 stores all over the US. My local store is here in Gainesville, Florida, and I've been multiple times. And the discounts you see online are applied also in the stores. So as I mentioned, 5-11 is offering you 15% off every purchase that you make. But I do want to say, more often than not, they have an even deeper discount, especially around holiday times. But if you use the code SHIELD15, that's SHIELD15, you will get 15% off your order or in the stores every time you make a purchase. And if you want to hear more about 5-11, who they stand for, and who works with them, listen to episode 580 of Behind the Shield podcast with 5-11 regional director, Will Ayers. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show former British paratrooper, member of the Tier 1 Special Forces, contractor, and co-founder of Red 8, Sean Bishop. Now, in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from his journey into the military, para regiment selection, special forces training, leadership, fitness, his deployments overseas, fighting amongst the Ukrainian soldiers, the ordnance that took part of his skull, his road to recovery, his weapons training company, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 900 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Sean Bishop. Enjoy. Well, Sean, I want to say two things. Firstly, thank you to our mutual friend, Dave Sanders, for connecting us. And secondly, I want to welcome you to the Behind the Shield podcast today.
No worries, mate.
So where on planet Earth are we finding you this afternoon?
So I'm in Florida, actually, Ormond Beach in Florida.
So that's not too far from me, but obviously people listening, they can tell neither of us are originally from here. So let's start at the very beginning of your timeline then. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings.
I was born in Norfolk, in England. I have a sister and obviously a mother and father. My mum was a housewife and my dad has done kind of a variety of jobs, but he mostly worked in parish councils.
Okay. So when you were a young boy going through the school ages, what were you playing as far as sports and exercise?
Blimey. So really, I've never been a big fan of sports. I played football as a youngster, as many kids do. But I mostly just kind of ran. That was all I did.
What about military families? Do you have any aunties, uncles, grandparents that did serve?
So, yeah, my grandfather, he was an infantry soldier in World War II, wounded on Anzio Beachhead. He was probably one of my earliest kind of references to the military.
A lot of that generation are notorious for not really talking about it very much. And I think, you know, that's what we're finally unpacking now in our generation, is that we are, you know, making it normal to discuss what we saw and did. When you look back, were there any discussions with him about his experience in World War II? Because sadly, that's a generation that, you know, we're hearing the stories now through the children and grandchildren rather than the soldiers themselves.
Everything was kind of age appropriate with my grandfather. It wasn't really until he knew I was really serious about going into the army. That he started to kind of open up on things.
Did he discuss any of the experiences that he had that you can relay?
He kind of, how would you say, he opened up about kind of the Battle of Anzio, how he was wounded. Would never talk badly about any medical people. So he had a real kind of affinity for medical people.
And did he stay in after World War II? And if not, what did he transition into?
No, he was demobbed, I think in 45, 46. Demobbed, came back to Norfolk, and kind of just carried on, had a family. I think he had three kids, and that was him, really.
When you look back at your early life then, you know, we're obviously going to get into special forces selection, that kind of thing. What elements of your childhood do you think contributed to you having the physical and or mental toughness to complete such a vigorous selection when so many people rang the bell?
Good question. I really don't know. It was, how would you say? It was one of those things I just kind of went into, got my teeth into, and just wouldn't let go. So it was, not to put too fine a point on it, it was very difficult. I kind of struggled with everything far more than many people who didn't make it all the way to the end. But I kind of hung in there and slipped through one of the holes in the net. So
were you dreaming of joining the military and or special forces when you were still at school?
Yeah, I was. So right from maybe 5 or 6 years old, that was all I'd wanted to do. So I think I watched A Bridge Too Far about Operation Market Garden when I was maybe 6 or 7. And I was like, that's kind of what I want to do. So I did.
And how old were you when you enlisted then? You signed up?
16. So, yeah, I was pretty young.
And talk to me about 16 you physically, because I heard you on your friend's podcast, All in Black. You made a comment that suggested you weren't the kind of pit bull that you've become as an adult.
No, I actually weighed 52 kilos, which is literally half of what I weigh now. So it was, I was in a kind of a weird test time for my unit. So you used to have to be 16 years and 9 months old to join a combat arm. If you joined at 16, you usually went to a thing called junior para and kind of did a, not a toned down, but a kind of version of depo that was age appropriate until you were old enough to kind of go to adult depo and finish your training. Now they run a thing called Army Foundation College at Harrogate. I was in the in-between stage, so they had neither thing running, and I was in a, it failed miserably, but I was in a test program to see if you could put 16-year-olds in with everybody else. Nearly all of us got kind of broken in one way or another. And yeah, I just kind of managed to grit my teeth, hang in there and get through.
I'm about to interview Mick Southall, who's one of the paras on the Falkland Islands.
I know Mick.
Oh, you do? I was wondering if you probably did. Yeah. Another one I had on probably about a year ago now was John Geddes under pseudonym John Graham. Yeah, SAS as well. Mick, I know, got enlisted at 16 as well. And it's fascinating. By 17, he was out, fighting, not on Goose Green. He was in a different battle, but... I think about now, my son next door is almost 17, and it's just crazy to think that that child would be at war. When you look back now with this kind of veteran lens that you have, what is your perspective on 16-year-old soldiers?
I mean, I have, personally, I have no regrets. I kind of got through. Looking at it now, I'm a little hypocritical. I have a 17-year-old daughter. If she wanted to join the military, I would suck it up and support her, but I wouldn't like it. It's one of those things, it works out, but it needs a finer lens. You need to kind of magnify everything and kind of take care of kids when they join.
Someone came on recently who was, I think they were US military, and they made an interesting point that a lot of the kids that are at the military age now, they grew up, and we're talking about children of military members, they grew up where all their parents had known was war, whether they stayed in the full 20 years, but that was a part of their day-to-day living. So unlike, let's say, the 1990s, maybe mother or father didn't really deploy a lot over those times, so the military maybe seemed like a better option. But they said that one of the reasons why they thought that the recruitment was harder now is a lot of children of military members that saw the last 20 years didn't enjoy it, that mom or dad was always gone, that, you know, they came back different, whatever it was. So what's your perspective of you know, through your daughter's lens, of her perception of war, not so much what you see, but from a family dynamic point of view?
I think it's been kind of difficult. It's always difficult to say your goodbyes, but it's always nice to come home. What she kind of feels or thinks about me, I don't know. You would kind of have to ask her. But we've always kind of wrestled with that and just kind of put up with it, if you like.
Absolutely. All right, well then let's go to your journey in the military. So you're 50 plus kilograms, you know, you enter, you know, the military, and not just the military, but the para kind of on ramp. So what did those first few years look like for you, and how did you create resilience in your body and your mind to overcome that initial physical deficit that you had?
It was really difficult at times. All I did was just not give up. So I think I started with 50 something people, and I passed out with 10 of us kind of passed out. Got posted to two para. That was kind of strange, turning up to battalion. I was so small, so light, and you could have sneezed and blown me out of a door. I was so small, but it was a crazy time. It was a strange experience.
So when you were in that phase of your life, where did you find yourself being deployed before you went to Special Forces?
So my first deployments were to Northern Ireland. I think I did a couple of tours of Ireland. I then went to Sierra Leone, Macedonia, Afghanistan, and Iraq. So I kind of bounced around all over the place, really. But
when I have British military members and they talk about their Northern Ireland deployments, a lot of times they struggled because, you know, it was, and I've always said the same thing. You know, to me, England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, we're all one little nation. Yes, we've got lines dividing the four, but we're all the same people on two tiny rocks in the middle of the ocean. And so they struggled with policing or soldiering against, you know, really their own people. What was your experience in Northern Ireland specifically?
So where were we? I kind of policed a little bit of rioting around. It was a bridge. I can't remember the name of it now. It was a bridge, and one side wanted to cross the bridge. The other side didn't want them to. We kind of stood in the middle, split the two sides up, and got bricked, bottled, and everything else. But it was early days, but it was what it was. It was a good experience. I think by the time I got there, it was all very refined. All the SOPs and everything were firmly in place. And it probably saved a lot of lives. Northern Ireland and all our experience kind of there probably saved a lot of lives when we ended up getting to Iraq and Afghanistan and everywhere.
Apart from Northern Ireland, then, was a lot of the training still, you know, what I would think like Salisbury Plain, a little bit more World War II leaning, but then Northern Ireland gave you more of that kind of urban combat?
Yeah, it was. So how would you say? It was a different time in the army. So although Northern Ireland was there, it wasn't what you trained towards all the time. It was looked at as something that had just been. So you just went, did it, kind of sucked it up. And you were always ready for the whistle blowing on the big one. So
Now, what about Sierra Leone? I had a young man, Ishmael Bey, on the show, and he was a child soldier during that conflict. And his parents had been murdered, and he'd been, like so many boys, captured and given two options. Do you want to die or do you want to fight? Those are your two options. They're feeding him drugs and those kind of things. What was that country's perspective at the time that you were there?
Sierra Leone was a little bit strange. So I can remember walking into my house. I can't remember whether it was mum or dad pressed the answering machine to listen to their messages. There was a garbled message from one of the guys in my platoon. Basically, you need to get back. We're going to war. So I was kind of sort of slapped in the face a little by that, but we weren't on any standby or anything like that. Everybody thought at every stage, this is going to be one of those slow burn kind of things. We'll all come back. It'll all calm down. It'll go away. We all got back. They were like, throw your shit in a bag, boys. We're going. So I was kind of like, okay, right. You know, we'll kind of get partway there, turn around, come back, threw all our shit in a bag, jumped on an aircraft, got to, I can't remember now where we got to, kind of got off, blazing hot sun, somebody goes, pointed to a Hercules down the end of the runway, see that plane? Yep, get on it. Right, okay. So we all got on it, sat on a Bergen's, no seats in a C-130. So we all sat on a Bergen. And I can remember somebody, like a couple back from me, going, do we make ready? Can we make ready? And it just rattled all around the aircraft. And in the end, one of the Falklands veterans sat on the tailgate, just stood up, clunk click. And then we ran off the back into Sierra Leone. So it was a little bit strange. I think we'd been there 40 minutes and they were like, patrols and snipers, drop your heavy kit. Someone's just been beheaded in Freetown Square. So we all had to go and kind of sort that out. But yeah, pretty nuts, pretty nuts.
Crazy. So what was it that took you from para to SF then? What made you make that decision?
It had always been one of those things. Before that, I was in the sniper platoon. I liked working in small groups. It was one of those things. I always looked at sort of special forces as the highest form of soldiering, and it was just one of those things that I kind of wanted to do.
What about physically? Like you said, you were 50-something kilograms. What did you do? What were the kind of strength and conditioning philosophies that you leaned into to add some weight?
I just lifted weights. I'm not a technique guy. I kind of just pick the heaviest thing you can move it, and then technique comes in over months and months. But it's probably not the wisest thing, but that was kind of how I used to train.
So what about 9/11? I mean, obviously, a lot of the American veterans, it was an attack on our home soil here, you know, where you're sitting as well. But it was a slightly different perspective for a lot of British, you know, serving military at the time, because it was on someone else's, you know, home front. It wasn't on ours. What was that day for you through your eyes, and how did that impact your trajectory?
So I literally came off sentry duty. I was actually in Macedonia. I came off sentry duty. We were living in an abandoned factory, and I was stood probably two or three people away from an exchange officer from the 82nd Airborne. So I was kind of right there, and there was one little television in front of most of the battalion, and I came in time to see the second tower collapse. I can remember one of the young lads asking, so what does this mean? And somebody goes, you're probably watching the start of the next World War, and probably wasn't too far off, to be fair.
Now, were you in SF by that point?
No. Okay. I was still 2-power.
So walk me through then. So Iraq was the next thing that you did under 2-power?
Yeah. Did Iraq. I actually went to Afghanistan before Iraq, but...
So walk me through that. I mean, again, you know, wherever you'd like to go, but you've done these deployments in Africa or Northern Ireland. Now, all of a sudden, we are truly, you know, at war. What were those kind of first Middle East experiences like when you were still in 2-power?
Just strange. It was really strange kind of being places. You know, you had the call to prayers kind of coming up. It was alien. It obviously became normal over time, but initially it was really alien. But I was in sniper platoon, so we always used to work in small teams, kind of remote from everybody. But it was odd. But I can remember, where did I fall to sleep? And I can remember having something poke me in the back, picked it up, threw it away. And when I woke up in the morning, it was the top of a human femur actually stuck in my back. So, yeah, that was a little strange. But
what about when you first went to Afghanistan and Iraq? Because what I've heard a lot is that people that were there early on in the conflict were more often than not received fondly by a lot of the people, the indigenous people of those countries, not the Taliban or, you know, the extremists, but the regular people. There was a feeling of, you know, liberation. What was the experience early on in either of those two countries?
Yeah, I mean, Afghanistan was a little different. We actually got shot at by the Northern Alliance, who were our allies. So they kind of had a crack at one of our OPs. It was just a distraction. They were actually trying to, nobody was paying them. They were trying to steal food. So they were like just shooting them and then kind of running, steal some food. So that's all it was. But Iraq was a little different. So again, I first went to Iraq in maybe 2003. And yeah, it was frosty, to say the least. So I think the initial kind of relief, you know, we were there when Saddam got caught. That caused a lot of celebratory fire. So it was literally like pull all the sentries in, everybody get underneath something, because everything that goes up obviously comes back down. Iraq was a little different.
Now, I always ask people one of two questions, and I'll put this to you, and this can span all the way through till present day, and we'll walk forward, obviously, with the other side of your, you know, more special forces focused profession. But as you live in the US now, I would argue that the people here on their news stations get a very polarized view of war, either very, very pro-war, kill them all, let God sort them out, stacking bodies, or they're all baby killers. And in the middle are the men and women, arguably children, 16, 17-year-olds, that we send overseas with their, you know, our flag on their shoulder to serve our country. The first part is a 2-part question. The first part, regardless of politics, regardless of what sent you there, was there a moment as a young soldier where you realized that there were some horrific people that needed to be taken care of?
Yeah, I mean, really, sort of going from way back when I was very, very young, I kind of made my peace with how the world is and who's in it, and the fact that kind of people in the military need to sort problems out. So that was never a real issue for me. I don't remember a sort of thunderclap reality bites moment, but
maybe the beheading right before you got off the plane was probably fitting that description.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then conversely, because this, I think this is as if not more important. the way that these conflicts are portrayed is that we're at war with Iraq, we're at war with Afghanistan, and obviously, you know, what you guys are doing are out there protecting the people of those countries from, you know, some of the people terrorizing them. So whether it was the indigenous people or whether it's people that you served alongside, what were moments of kindness and compassion amidst some of those battle zones that you witnessed throughout the years?
So jumping way forward to kind of SF, there was a particular kind of linguist. He was a Kurdish chap that I kind of worked with, who I got kind of pretty close with. He was a decent guy. He was kind of worth turning around and running back for, if it came to that.
Brilliant. All right. Well, then what year did you transition to SF? And then how did that change, you know, your perspective of war in the time that you were still in the regular military?
So I think it was 2010 that I was badged in. I did a summer selection course and just kind of got badged just before Christmas. But that was let's have a look, maybe round about 200 odd people, and it slimmed down to, well, 10 again. So not very good odds of passing, but it was nice to be kind of stood there at the end of that.
So again, with that lens, you know, you're a 16-year-old, you make it through the parachute regiment selection. Now you're 10 in 200 odds. What, by this point, do you think carried you through even greater adversities and still allowed you to succeed?
I think it was probably mindset. I think it was one of those things, just I saw an interview, and it was an old guy from my old unit, and he goes, the best piece of advice he ever got was, don't stop. And that was it. And I kind of, that sort of stuck in my head, just don't stop. Whatever you're doing, don't stop. So, yeah, it was a strange time. But it was, everything felt very worthwhile. Do you know what I mean? The things that you would get at the end were always kind of worth putting yourself through the mill for.
What was the contrast between parachute regiment and the SF unit that you were a part of ultimately? And the reason I ask that, you know, for example, the SEALs and the Green Berets and some of these other groups have come on the show. You know, they, especially if you're talking about SEAL Team 6, you know, they are given, yeah, you know, all of the latest technology. Obviously, they're given nutritionists and strength conditioning, and they're trying to forge the most elite of elite soldiers who then in turn, you know, do research and do training to help the other SEAL teams. What was that lens like through your unit compared to the parachute regiment? Was there an exposure to a higher level of training and equipment there?
Yeah, it was one of those things. You kind of got spat off the back of selection, feeling like you could do pretty much anything. You then went to your squadron and realised that you couldn't. Everything was, all right, geezers, you know the time and place, be there tomorrow with all your shit. And that was the only brief that you'd get. And then you were like, turning to guys that you'd knew, and you're like, where is the usual place? What time is it? And what do I bring? They were like, you'll get used to it. And you're like, well, I haven't and I can't. So what do I actually bring? But you did get used to it over a bit of time. Yeah, it took a lot of kind of working towards, really. I was quite lucky. I think I was a little bit older. A lot of the guys in the unit already knew me. So I had quite an easy transition when I first turned up. But yeah.
That minimalist instruction, was that because as you spent more time and you got more training, you already knew what each of these things meant? Because I know the best fire departments I work for, they would have a keyword, and that meant a whole series of things on the engine or on the truck. Was it that element that your training and frequency was so high that after a few months, you knew what that meant?
Yeah, you just kind of pick it up as you go along. So I can remember the first exercise that I did to kind of hit the ground. We jumped in and I sort of clunked all the parachute harness off, stood up and was about to go forward and get my rifle, Bergen and everything else, and pack my chute up, turned around, and squadron commander and the squadron sergeant major were doing it for me. So they just walked over and were kind of already doing it. And I was kind of like, this is a little different to what I know. But yeah, it was, I think the unit is one of those places, nobody will walk past the broom, nobody will walk past a crisp packet on the floor. Nobody feels kind of above themselves. So everyone's willing to kind of muck in. But
yeah. What is it about that philosophy in that group? Because it sounds to me like what's happened is there's humility. And you hear this with the SEALs, for example. They take it in turns leading. So it seems like the ego gets kind of stomped down a little bit and you have humility. Because now, regardless of rank, like you said, you're picking up rubbish and helping each other pack chutes so that as a group you can get finished. How was that forged in the SF team that maybe didn't have the opportunity in the paras?
So again, for me, it was a little different having come from kind of sniper platoon. But yeah, it was kind of very much that kind of thing. So because you work in small groups, you can't really afford to have a big strung out kind of hierarchy. The hierarchy is very compressed, and things work very differently. So if you have an officer that feels he's above everybody and he doesn't need to get his hands dirty, well, that's completely not the case. So, it was commissioned officers in particular used to get gripped when they turned up to a squadron, and it was literally like, grab by the collar, this is my troop, not yours, you do the paperwork and shut your mouth. It's kind of like, okay, right. So, yeah, it was, how would you say, a squadron's is kind of a weird organism, but it kind of works. I think it's just been sort of time proven. But
brilliant. Well, what about the next kind of phase of your military career then? How did that shift? And also tell me about the medic side too, because I know you became a combat medic under that role.
Yeah, so everybody that joins the unit, you go one direction or the other. You either go heavily into demolitions or heavily into med. You cross-train in both, but you do one in particular. And that's known as your patrol skill. My patrol skill ended up being med. So I kind of went on numerous sort of hospital attachments and did a fair amount of medical work.
Now, I've heard you talking, and we'll get into it, obviously, with the Ukraine, not even deployments, the Ukraine contracts that you've been through, and obviously the near life-death experience that you experienced. But while you were under that combat medic role, did you ever have to actually apply those skills?
Yeah, loads of times. So even right from being a young soldier all the way through to actually knowing what I was doing, I've treated hundreds and hundreds of casualties over that time. But
what, if any, observations have you had between the medicine that you had to use on the battlefield and some of the medicine that you watched in the civilian side when you were training?
So I suppose it's really mechanism of injury. So people in the civilian world, they're used to getting people that are very, very poorly, but there's no sort of visual kind of sign of that. they're just really ill. And it'll be kind of taking people's odds that sort of indicates things. Whereas in the military side of things, you're dealing with fit and healthy people that get torn up by kind of pieces of metal going a bit too quickly. So it's really, how you turn the tap off, how you kind of stop bleeding, how you keep people breathing and kind of those kind of things. But
so now you've become, on the SF side, you're working under that banner now. Where do you find yourself and how is that different now versus where you were under Tupara before?
I suppose it was very different. You worked in a lot smaller groups. When they said things would happen, they usually did. So if they said, a plane's going to land on that road in 20 minutes, 20 minutes later, plane would land on the road. I suppose looking at it, you got kind of the more dangerous side of soldiering, but it kind of just worked. People were so good that you didn't have to kind of look to your left and right. You just knew that people there were going to kind of do what they needed. So you just sort of concentrated on your bit of that.
And where did you find yourself? Were you back in Iraq and Afghanistan during that time too?
Yeah, both of those places. Numerous times, but with a couple of other ones that we won't go into. Mostly Iraq and Afghanistan.
And what, if any, were the differences between when you went the first time and then when you went back years later?
I think just how things had kind of moved on. So what was all new, and we were kind of trying to apply things that we'd learned in Ireland and the early days, everything had kind of refined and kind of moved on to such a point where everything was established off what you'd learned in those theatres. So everything just kind of rolled, really. But.
And what made you make the decision to transition from that role into the world of contracting?
It was just my time was up. So it was one of those things that I just kind of got out into. I actually got out right when the COVID disaster kind of struck. Everybody on camp got stood down, sent home on full pay, apart from me. So I was kind of like, but I managed to find work pretty rapidly, and I went and worked out in Libya for 8 months, actually.
What was that transition like for you? The reason I ask that, a lot of our first responders, military members, when they leave that tribe, when they leave that group that they were so close to, and they had identity, they had purpose, they had that tribe, like I said, it can be very jarring for people. To transition out during COVID, I could imagine probably was pretty rough to come out expecting to be able to hug people and spend quality time, and now you're in that nightmare.
No, it was, I think, with a strong kind of family around you, that kind of works out. Plus, I went and worked in Libya with a few ex-regiment guys. It was kind of one home to another, really. But
a lot of the people that have been on here, British and American and Australian, the withdrawal from Afghanistan definitely stung, for lack of a better word. And it's not to say that they don't feel like they made a difference, because all of them can recall where, you know, they definitely did impact where they were kind of deployed. But the way that it was, you know, snatched out and the interpreters that were left behind, the equipment that was left behind, seemed to really sit very badly with a lot of people that served, a lot of people that, you know, had trauma mentally and physically that came home, a lot of people that lost friends that didn't come home. What was the kind of your perception of that particular event?
I would call that an absolute disaster. I kind of looked at it and yeah, it was pretty much disastrous. I mean, all the gear that was left out there, all the people we kind of left behind, kind of stuck in the throat a little, that did, but just one of those things.
Yeah. All right, well then let's shift to Ukraine then. Talk to me about, now you're on the contracting side, the beginning of that conflict, and then when you found yourself deployed there the first time, or sent there the first time.
So I found work with a company that kind of looks after a lot of guys from my old unit. And I was bodyguarding for a news crew. So I was kind of bodyguarding for reporters. I'm going to be careful what I'm going to say, but I found out pretty quickly I really don't get along with reporters very well. They would say the wrong thing. It would wind me up. There were numerous kind of days where I would refuse to talk to them. And when you're shutting a vehicle with somebody for hour after hour, not talking to them can kind of wear a little thin. But yeah, it was one of those things. So I went out in very late February, literally just after the Russians had kind of come across the border. Originally, I went to look after a news crew that was covering the refugee crisis right on the border with Poland. So I went to a place called Medyka, and it had thousands and thousands of people, and I'm talking about 5 or 6 kilometers of a four-lane road, literally jam-packed with people standing, and it was taking them 3 or 4 days to get to the front of that queue. That kind of slapped me right in the face. I was kind of, the scale of it and the amount of kind of people was different to a lot of what I'd seen before. But was what it was. It was one of those things. The crew that I was looking after was like, we don't want to go into Ukraine. And I was like, I need to go into Ukraine. So I got moved to another crew and walked them across the border. And then just kind of worked in a lot of places where the Russians had literally just pulled out. So it was places like Borodyanko, Bucha, places like that, and they'd literally just left. So kind of went in there, was exposed to a lot of what the Russians had got wrong. Numerous kind of things that sort of mess with your equilibrium a little. There were tons of kind of crimes that they'd sort of committed. Watched the mass grave in the back of the churchyard in Bucha, kind of get kind of all the bodies get pulled out of there. It was a funny time though.
I heard you on your podcast you did with your friend. You made that same comment about the media, but you also talked about the way that it was reported only fit a certain narrative. With Ukraine, or even going further back, what has been your experience between, you know, just that, what you're seeing versus the way that, and obviously we can't report everything that's going on, that could be very detrimental to security, but the way that the story is being told back home versus what you guys are seeing on the ground?
So the network that I worked for, it used to get told, and this was get told from over here. So they would make a decision in, I think it was New York or LA, wherever their kind of base was, they would get told what the news is today. They would go out, clip photographs, bits of footage, soundbite people, and just make it fit whatever they'd already been told. And you were like, this is absolute bullshit. Do you know what I mean? They completely ignored the big ironworks in Mariupol, so which is one of the most legendary kind of feats of arms that we've had in recent years. They completely ignored it, weren't interested in it. A female reporter got asked by one of the interpreters, why don't you interview soldiers? And she was like, no, we want to interview real people. And I was like, fucking real people? Well, what am I? Because I'm all that's keeping you stood up. But yeah, it was, it kind of blew my mind a little. But
what would you tell people listening that wasn't reported through a lot of the TV back home? You know, what were some of the things that, if anything, that were missing from the kind of the picture that we were given as far as, you know, why we were there, what was actually happening? You know, like you said, some of the things some of the things that the Russians and or the Ukrainians were doing that the American and British people weren't being told.
I think it was probably the raw element, like going right down to, how would you say, today we are going to have to suck it up. We're going to have to run risks and we're going to push right forward. A lot of them weren't happy to do that. Some of them did it stupidly and were shot. And you're kind of like, if you just listen to your security guys, they could probably keep you out of trouble. There was quite a few, how would you say, really quite brutal crimes that they just never reported. I mean, Bucha, there were guys getting pulled out of forests and arms tied together, hands cut off, tongues cut out, eyes gouged out, and bits and pieces cut off. And you're like, we telling this story or no, we need to find somebody in it. Everything was really weird. It was just a strange kind of air about the whole thing. But yeah.
So with the position that you had now, again, not trying to get too in the weeds, but how did the men that you served alongside in this capacity help bolster the Ukraine forces?
Where are you talking about? Looking after the media or?
Later. So I think I'm transitioning. Let me rephrase the question then, now that you've educated me. How did you find yourself transitioning from the protection side to actually being more on the combat side?
So it was kind of, it was one of them moments where, how would you say, I made a decision, you are not doing enough. Not to put too fine a point on it, I think I was making 14 or 15 thousand pounds a month looking after reporters. I halved that and went and worked for an American company ran by an ex-MARSOC guy. Their job was either training up Ukrainian units or extracting civilians out of frontline areas that were looking at getting surrounded or overrun. So they were too dangerous for anybody else to kind of try. I went and worked for them for a little while. Still didn't think I was doing enough. So I ended up joining the Legion.
The Foreign Legion?
Yeah, it's the Ukrainian kind of Foreign Legion. But,
okay.
Yeah, it was a strange transition. One of the older guys that worked for the company I was with, he actually joined it before I did. I kind of got, how would you say, bluffed into it. So I went and met a couple of guys in Kyiv, had a bit of food and a couple of drinks with them, and they talked me into joining their unit. And the talk was, look, we work behind the lines, we run human teams, we're blowing up trains, we're kind of living in small groups in the forest. And I was kind of like, yeah, that sounds like a bit of me. I'll sign up. And they were like, yeah, good to go. I'll kind of claim you. Just go do your paperwork. Went, did the paperwork, got to the, got up to where they were. And the guy that had that conversation with me and basically sold the unit was basically like, looked at me and was like, okay, anyway, I'll catch you later. I'm off to Kyiv. And I was kind of like, mate, I don't even know where to have a pee. I don't know who anybody is. Like, what am I doing here? But he literally threw the unit at me. So that kind of happened. But
what was your mindset by this point? Because you were a skinny young kid. You get into the paras. You know, that starts building you up. Then you join the SF team. But now you found yourself, you know, protecting journalists, which doesn't sound like it was a career high for you. And then now you're in the Legion. That kind of burning why, had that shifted? Did you find yourself kind of looking for that mission, or was the conflict that you were witnessing enough to keep you driving forward?
No, it was. So, I mean, I originally went to Ukraine just to put food on the table. That was as simple as it was. When I got there, it really kind of knocked me around, kind of mentally and emotionally. So I was kind of like, right, somebody needs their head cracking over this. So I thought I would give it a pop. So I kind of fell forward into the Legion, kind of worked in the unit that I've already spoke about for a little while. Got back off a job, and how would you say, the characters in the Legion are a little bit of a random bunch. So I had everything you could imagine. I had bikers, minor criminals, ex-soldiers, Jews, Nazis, every single thing you could imagine I had under my small little banner. This was within about 15 or 16 people. And I can remember being like, holy shit, do you know what I mean? These were a bit of a random bunch. But the majority of them were good, loyal people. They'd all kind of made a choice to come and fight for Ukraine. And they were about as blunt as a house brick coming through your windscreen. So they approached me after a job and they were like, just letting you know, we work for you now, not him. And that was literally about 6 feet away from our old commander, and they literally just sacked him. So I had a vote and kind of sacked him, which kind of left me kind of running the show for a little while. I ended up getting quite close to another friend of mine, who I kind of worked with a fair bit. He was a former Coldstream Guards commissioned officer. Spoke with a plum in his mouth, was a very posh guy, but was always up for a good fight, basically. So we volunteered for a couple of funny little jobs, got into some kind of bad scrapes, and they approached the pair of us to kind of lead them onwards. So we formed something we called Grey Team. We said, we'll never turn down a job because it's too dangerous. So here we are. We're a small group. We'll keep it really select. We'll pick who we want in it. And we'll just kind of offer our services to anyone. Our kind of way of thinking was, if we're a small group, that doesn't mind taking risks. We can just go around the country, anywhere, to anyone and offer them help. We didn't want any kudos or congratulations, no pats on the back or anything like that for getting work done. We would hand that over to the bigger unit. And I think it kind of worked. So we had a bit of a reputation. We were actually called Suicide Squad for a little while. And I think people looked at us as kind of like pirates. So that was actually how our CO used to introduce us. So he used to gabble in Ukrainian and you ask people what he'd said. And he was like, they're a bunch of pirates, but they're good guys. So do you know what I mean? That was kind of how it was.
Did that reputation spread to Russian troops? You know, you hear of some of these notorious snipers on the Allied sides of World War II that, you know, are known by the Nazis. Did it ever kind of, you ever hear back from the Russians or no?
No, it wasn't around for long enough to get a reputation like that. It was kind of very short-lived because both me and Ned were badly wounded, probably seconds apart. So it didn't really go that far after that. But
well, let's talk about that day then. So, you know, tell me about why you guys were called to that particular scene and then kind of walk us through, you know, the incredibly tragic events that led to some deaths and your near death as well.
So we were already on a pretty rough job. We got the call. Don't ask any questions, just get yourself to here. So we had to drive hours to get to the outskirts of Bakhmut. Got there and we got told, you know, we were very small at the time, but we got told, look, there are 9 Ukrainians stuck in the basement of a building that's full of Russians. We've tried to break them out twice. It hasn't worked. I got asked, because I was the only ex-tier one guy, are you willing to lead 40 men in to bust them out? And I was like, I don't know this area, but if somebody can get me to the building, I'll lead your assault. So, yeah. So I kind of volunteered to lead it. We put in a lot of planning. So the target building, it was quite a big building, probably the size of, I don't know, roughly 3 detached houses in UK. 3 floors above ground, a basement underneath, and that's where the 9 Ukrainians were. The building was full of Russians. The whole Russian army was in full assault. So, I mean, thousands of infantry, hundreds of armoured vehicles, jets, helicopters, drones, everything you could imagine in full assault mode had swept over the top of that. We were kind of hitting the backfield forces. And 2 attempts had kind of already failed at getting them out. So it was a bit of a strange one. The guys the night before we got there had hit a mine in the dark, took casualties, withdrawn under fire in the pitch dark. So my head's kind of whirling and I'm like, okay, dark is out because some of our guys didn't have night vision. The only way you find a mine or an IED at night is to set it off. So I was like, right, that is out. The building itself was in a little row of buildings leading to some big kind of barns that were full of Russians as well. It was in a strip of buildings and it was in a strip woods right next to a train track. So I said, right, the strip woods is out because guys have been hit. We can't see through it with our own drones. So Strip Woods was 8, Dark was 8. We had a Ukrainian guy who had done sentry duty before and knew some of the 9 guys that were already there. He had done sentry duty in that actual building, so he knew which one it was. His job was to take us to it and literally give us that. Wait until we fought to the basement, come forward, speak to the Ukrainians through the door, get them to pop the door, come out. We were then going to bundle them up and get them sort of straight back the way we came in. The way we were going to do that was I arranged for a big distraction. So a lot of artillery, a lot of mortars kind of hitting things near, far, kind of scattered targets all over the area. And my whole idea was just get every Russian in the area to hit the ground, put his head down, and not want to stick it up. Our job was we were going to go straight down the train track, get the target building indicated, hit it with every missile that we were carrying, run forward, fight to the basement, grab a mace, and get them backed away. To say it didn't go quite that way is a bit of an understatement, but it didn't. But
did the Russians know they were beneath them?
Yeah, they knew. I'll be honest, kind of looking at it now, I think they were using them as bait. They just left them. They could have easily bust down the door, threw a charge down there and just wiped them all out. But I think they were using that to draw in Ukrainians. And they were like, how many of these guys do you reckon we can kill? Just keep them coming. So that was kind of what I think they did. And it worked. It worked pretty well. So the whole distraction and everything, us taking the Ukrainian, that worked up to the point where he literally indicated the target building. I was just spreading the guys out. We were about 20 meters away from the building, and a Russian just sprints out the front door with a red flare in his hands and pops it. So this kind of took us a little by surprise. We shot him. He actually managed to stay on his feet. You could watch dust popping off his gear, but he stayed on his feet and actually made it back in the building. Probably died straight away from the amount of holes that we put in him. And that kicked everything off. So we immediately came under fire from, I don't know, 4 or 5 different positions. Kind of took care of that. You could see a lot of Russians kind of moving around in the target building. I gave a standby for rapid, gave a rapid fire, and I went forward alone to find a breach point. Why did I go alone? Just didn't want anybody to get shot up or grenaded. So I kind of pushed forward, survived, got to the building, and I was like, right, I need to check this doorway. Kind of did a pie maneuver. So you kind of step around the door, pointing your weapon inside, and it kind of gives you awareness of kind of what's inside. You get to kind of check out for tripwires and everything. And I literally came, because I couldn't push too far away from the building, because otherwise I was going to get shot from above. I literally came pretty much muzzle to muzzle with a Russian. He went to raise his rifle. I shot him, stepped back out of the doorway. The lads all open up. So they fired missiles, machine guns, rifles, everything through every opening. And kind of put that to bed. I shouted that I need more guys, got 3 guys. I'm kind of stacked up on the door, and I was like, we're going in, squeeze my shoulder when you're ready. Got the shoulder squeeze, stepped again, another Russian was stood right where his mate had died. He actually had his rifle up and fired, hit the woodwork and the brickwork right next to my face. That kind of stuck a load of brick dust in my eyes. Shot him, laid him out, was still under fire from further back in the building. So I shrunk in, took a knee next to the door, and kind of took care of that. Then heard the shout grenade, and grenades started getting kind of thrown out of the top floor at us. I couldn't get more than two syllables out without a grenade going off, and I mean within feet of us. So it was grenade, boomf, grenade, boomf. Anyway, we're going in, lad, right, grenade, boomf. And it kind of wore a little thin. So I'm like, right, follow me, pull back. Pulled everyone back to the wall, or what was left of the wall, about 20 metres away. Undid the knot in our knickers, gave it another go. Same thing happened. So we were like, right, fucking pull back. Pull back to the building next door that had been cleared by another team. So we kind of pulled into there. That carried on ages. So I think we all up hit it 14 or 15 times, just backwards, forwards, backwards, forwards. My friend Ned took a bullet through his shoulder. So actually got shot through the shoulder. Completely ignored that. He was like, my shoulder's stiff. One of the boys kind of pulled his shirt open. He's like, mate, you've been shot. He was like, nah, fuck it, just put it back on. I'll carry on. So it's kind of like, right, okay. Then we got to a certain stage and one of the lads actually grabbed me and he goes, this, how many times are we going to hit this thing? And I was like, yeah, fair one. So I asked the Ukrainian major who was there. I was like, look, mate, how many times do you want us to hit this building? And he was up for sacking it right there and then. He was like, look, you've hit it enough times. Let's go back now. The captain literally grabbed me and big wide eyes. He's like, that's our men in there. Don't fucking leave them. So I'm kind of like, fuck, you've got me there. Right. Everybody fucking stand up who could still stand. Had to stand down a couple of lads because they were too badly hurt to kind of assault. On my ass, follow me. So I led one more attack. Ned, at the target building, literally pile drivers me onto the floor. Grenade goes off. Bang. He's fragged in the back, which I bollock him about now, but it was what it was. I got knocked back from a grenade blast, so I was actually stacked up on the corner of the door. Grenade went off in the door. That knocked me back. Another guy kind of took my place, shake my head, kind of get back up, recontrol it, kind of realise this just isn't working. Let's pull back to the kind of building. So we pull back into the building. It's hit by a huge munition that kind of shook loads of shit off the ceiling. I'm like, right, everyone out. There was kind of a bit of confusion at that time. And then you get man down. So I'm like looking at everybody and literally everybody that had come with me on all those assaults. I thought I'd done fairly well, because I wasn't holed up at the time, so I had no kind of fragments, no gunshot, no nothing. So I thought I'd done pretty well, but everybody else was full of holes at the time. So I'm like, right, if somebody's man down and everybody is kind of holed up and kind of bleeding, Ned had been shot and fragged at the time, and it's kind of like, somebody must be really fucking hurt. So I run back down the line. I get to Joe, who didn't make it. Go to Joe, mate, who's the man down and what state is he in? He goes, I don't know, brother, not sure. And at that time, everybody comes kind of spilling past. I grab one of the guys and I'm like, what's going on? He goes, mate, the lads are done in. They need to go back. So I'm like, right, fucking you lead them back to the friendly checkpoint. Give me a last man call. So everybody kind of comes blundering past. Ned, after being shot and fragged, wouldn't leave. Just he stayed right to the end with me, which is pretty decent of him. But we kind of got to that stage where last man goes through, so we kind of chip off. And by this time, you can kind of hear that the Ruskies had had drones up for ages, so we were getting plastered with kind of mortars and artillery all the time. You could hear armour moving on both sides of us. It was a bit of a mess, but we start kind of cracking on back towards the friendly checkpoint. And the Ukrainian major and captain just stop, go down, and they're arguing over a radio. So I take a knee, face the rear, because I'm the last man to leave. And in the end, I'm like, Ned, what are they doing? So Ned kind of walks up, listens to them both, and then looks at me with this worried look on his face. And he's like, they still got wounded back there. I'm like, right, okay, well, we got to go back for them. So we already had wounded. We had a lot of wounded. So I'm like, one of the boys, right, you lead them back to the friendly checkpoint. We'll go back and grab the Ukrainian wounded. So the major, the captain, and Ned, we all kind of group together and kind of go to walk off. And Cy, who also didn't make it, kind of latches on the back of us. Ned looks at him and he goes, Bish said to go back to the friendly checkpoint. And he just stares at him and goes, fuck off. So that happened. And five of us kind of walked back in, expecting to literally meet, you know, Russians toe to toe. I think we get, I don't know, roughly sort of 300 odd metres back towards them. We hear a load of crashing and kind of movement ahead. So all kind of weapons up, waiting for what we thought might be the Russians. Two Ukrainians come blundering through the trees. One of them's got no weapon, is really bleeding heavily out of one arm. Literally grab hold of him. I'm like, are you all right? And he's like, yep. So I'm like, right, fucking move that way. Don't hang around. Him and his mate chip off. The Ukrainian major gives us a thumbs up. So I'm like, right, let's fucking about turn. Let's go back. So we start moving back towards the friendly checkpoint. All the way down, it was a dead straight train track that kind of went on for ages. And all the way down it, you could just hear explosions really close to us, armour kind of moving in. You could see the friendly checkpoint from miles away, and it was getting hammered. Big explosion after big explosion. And I'm like, fuck, we can't move either side. We can't kind of alter our course here. We just need to suck it up and get down there. That was the safest place to go. So we kind of keep cracking on. We get to a little slope that starts kind of pulling up to the checkpoint. The Ukrainian major, who was leading our little group, literally takes a knee and just refuses to move. So I again take a knee. I'm facing the rear. I'm like, Ned, what is he doing? So Ned walks up to him. They have a little argument. Ned takes a pace backwards, raises his rifle, and he's like, I will fucking shoot you where you're kneeling if you don't get up and move over that berm. So the major's like, gives it one of those, and then kind of gets up and moves over. it wasn't until I got to that point I could kind of see in his mind why he didn't want to sort of push over. The other side of the berm was pure carnage. So there's dead, wounded, laid everywhere. Everybody's voice had raised a couple of octaves. I think panic was about to set in. There were guys sort of self-tourniqueting. It was a bit of a mess. So I'm like, shit. Okay. So I take literally center stage, just talk calmly to everyone, like, you pull him over there, you tourniquet him, you do this. And I try and calm everything down, which kind of worked until T-72 round, so that's a main battle tank, lands within kind of inches of me and blows me completely off my feet. Ned clearly remembers watching that explosion. So he said he literally watches the explosion, watches me disappear in the explosion. And he's like, his heart fucking sinks because he's like, that's all the control is on him now. He goes, he kind of keeps looking and he goes, I just pop back up and start working like nothing's changed. And he goes, that kind of blew his mind a little bit, but you know, is what it is. A few of the guys were looking at me with strange looks on their faces. So I just go, no dramas, and kind of give the thumbs up and just carry on. So I kind of continued to control everything, which works for a little while. Then there's a big explosion. And then you hear, man down, it's Ned. I'm like, oh, fuck. So I run down off the little hill that I was on and up his up the slope to Ned. And he was in a bad way. So he'd been hit full on with an artillery shell. He'd kind of blown his legs apart. He had kind of bones stuck out of him and was a little bit of a mess. He was close to going into shock at that point. So I look at him and I'm like, we need to get him down the hill. He needs a doctor fucking straight away. So four of us kind of grab bits of him and kind of drag him down this slope. We get him part way down and it was kind of, there were trees stuck everywhere, kind of blown up trees. And we kind of hook him on a tree. So literally it's bone one side, Ned the other side, which hurt him, obviously. He let us know. It was like, oh shit. So we move him back up, unhook him, eventually kind of get him down the hill, throw him in the back of a vehicle. I grab his head, pull him over, give him a kiss, whisper something in his ear, and say to the driver, right, fucking get him out of here now. There was another big load of artillery, another load of casualties. That all kind of kicks off. So Ned's vehicle goes absolutely nowhere. I take centre stage again, calm everything down, kind of working through everything. And that's when the second T-72 round literally goes off right in between my legs. So I was on one knee and it literally came in. And that one really knocked me for six. So I can remember fucking being laid on my back, smoke everywhere, fucking peel my head up and just look down at a complete mess. So it had blown the inside off both legs and the back off my right leg. I was like, oh shit, you're not in a very good state here. So I remember shouting over and I fucking shout, Ned, point down. And he just gives me a really weak thumbs up, which is kind of funny now. But yeah, it was just one of them, one of those things. So after that, I don't really remember much. But from survivors of the day, they said everybody was screaming at me, get in a fucking trench, get in a trench. So I managed to get back to my feet, walk over to the lads that are taking cover in a trench, there was Joe, George, Cy, Bruce and Carey. I kind of move over to them, heard 152 mil artillery shell coming in, so that started whistling. I took a knee on the lip of the trench and put my head down, and the round actually lands in the trench. Killed Joe, killed Cy, killed George, severed an artery in Bruce's arm and knocked Carey stiff and blew 4 square inches out of my skull. And made me look dead. So that happened. I don't obviously remember any of that. Carey, I think, jumped out of the trench, ran over to someone else who was kind of hit, started treating them. Bruce screams my name, tries to drag me in the trench, but he's got a severed artery in his arm. He works out I'm dead, because I look freaking dead. Runs over to Carey. Carey grabs him, goes, he's fucking dead and you're hit. Tourniquets his arm and casavags him. And then I think somewhere I was left for dead. I think eventually somebody kind of checked me. I must have made a noise or something, and they were like, fucking hell, he's still in the game. Patched me up, sent me to a field hospital. They saved my legs. I was then packaged further north because they knew they didn't have the neuro experience to kind of deal with my head injury. And I went up to Dnipro. So that was the story. And out of 40 men that went forward, 14 were dead. And nearly everybody else was injured, lightly or otherwise. But yeah, not the best of days, that.
No, absolutely awful day. Just before we go to your recovery, when people listen, obviously not just yourself, the men you worked alongside as well. I mean, the courage and the heroism against the odds that you were facing was pretty, you know, epic, for lack of a better word. When you kind of analyze it now, what was it that allowed you to overcome that immense fear and keep pushing forward?
Again, I think it was just that don't stop kind of philosophy. I think we were always taught when it's a hostage rescue, which it was, all bets are off. So if all of you die doing a hostage rescue, just crack on, just get it done. And I think that was kind of my mindset through the entire thing. So it was just don't stop, just keep going, kind of carry on. Everybody worked really well. The lads that I was with, I can't speak highly enough of them. They were all really good guys.
They sound amazing. They really do. What about your road to recovery then? I mean, we're sitting here having a conversation. You're still extremely active these days. Walk me through losing 4 square inches of what one would imagine to be a pretty important organ to your kind of journey out the hospital.
So, yeah, I was shipped north to the hospital in Dnipro. My wife came out to see me, which was pretty impressive. I was in a medical coma at the time. It was kind of a long sort of road to recovery. I went up to Dnipro, kind of stayed there for a little while they sorted my head out. I was moved up to Kyiv, stayed there for a little while, and then I was packaged over the border and moved somewhere else. And eventually I moved all the way. I moved via London all the way back home. But I was in London for the majority of my recovery time. So I actually spent 4 months in hospital, 4 solid months. And that was on £1,000 a day. of antibiotics. But
what were your deficits, if any, when you first, you know, gained consciousness and were able to move? Did you have any temporary damage as far as your physicality?
Well, initially, I could hardly speak. So it was one of those where my wife was stood there, getting everything kind of explained to her. They'd showed her my wounds. I was in a bad way. I was unconscious, laid on a bed. And the guy was saying, look, his speech might not come back for a couple of months. It's usually the last thing to come back. But, you know, we're kind of worried with his head injury, you know, whether it will. And the wife said, I kind of peeled one eye open, saw her, said, love you, and then piled in again. So that was kind of the first thing that I actually said was that.
You won some points there, so, that's for sure.
Yeah. It was a bit weird. The whole kind of thing was really odd. So they actually... They rebuilt the 4 square inches with a titanium plate and kind of put that back in. Because I did have a real curved kind of bit out of my head, which looked kind of weird when you looked at it. But yeah, they've kind of rebuilt it and done a decent job. So.
And what about getting to the point that you're at operationally now? I mean, was there a kind of on-ramp again? I mean, 4 months in hospital, obviously you're losing some of your fitness and your strength, and you've got the muscles that were damaged in your legs as well. So how are you able to kind of train yourself back to where you are now?
That's a good question, really. So with the bits that are kind of missing out of my legs, I think out of my right leg, I'm completely missing my adductor, so I'll never be able to twist my leg like I twisted it before. But it's just one of those things that you kind of have to get used to. It was a little weird when I first had a shower and I was like, fuck me, you are missing some chunks. But I'm only 4 kilos lighter than I was at my heaviest. So when you think of the bits that the Russians kind of blew off, I don't think 4 kilos is kind of workable. But
absolutely. Well, then let's walk to the creation of the Red 8 then. The way we were connected, like I said, Dave connected us, and you're right down the road from me, and you are giving, you know, weapons classes in this local area. So what made you decide to transition into that space alongside what you're still doing today?
I literally got approached by a friend of mine who I fought with over there, and he was like, do you want to start a business together? So I was like, well, how do you mean? He goes, well, I'll do all the admin and you teach. I was like, yep, good for me, mate. We'll crack on and do that. So that was kind of where Red 8 came from. Kind of nuts, but I've got to go back to Ukraine this week, actually. So the Ukrainians, although it's taken absolutely ages, they've given me a medal for that day. So that was kind of nuts. It was a guy I hadn't heard from for months, just kind of started texting me. I sort of texted him back. We did kind of a bat and ball for a couple of days. And he finishes off the one day, he goes, oh, I've got something here of yours. I'll send you a photo later. So I'm just thinking, somebody's found an old piece of gear and kind of handed it in. And he sends me a picture of my medal, which I thought was pretty nice of them, to be fair. So, yeah, turns out I'm getting a gong. So I've got to go and collect that, actually, this week. So, yeah. There's a few lads I actually would have put in for medals, but I don't know whether I'll be able to do that when I'm there. I'm not sure. Particularly Ned. Ned's been good as gold. He was a tough old boy on that day. But
yeah, Ned's still with us now. Have I got that correct?
Yeah.
Okay, beautiful. All right, well then, I want to get to what you offer in Red 8, but just before we do, through your lens, you know, we have obviously multiple conversations going on at the moment. I just interviewed Tulsi Gabbard, and you know, she was referring to the beginning of the Ukraine invasion and what we're seeing now as a proxy war compared to, you know, some of the other things that maybe we should have been focusing on, and we had the whole conversation on, you know, who benefits from initiating a war in the first place. But then you also have now what's going on in Gaza, and that rightly so has got a lot of people looking that way. Through your lens though, how is the situation in the Ukraine, and what needs to happen to assist them to finally get the Russians out of their country again?
That is a good question, and I don't think Ukraine will finish quickly. I think it's a bit more of a grind. It's just one of those things, you constantly need support. So whatever kind of stuff you can give them, whatever kind of help, and that's everything from a pair of warm socks to cruise missiles. It's kind of and everything in between. Just kind of keep supporting them, and that's really, you'll eventually have to kind of get to that stage where one of them kind of gives up and pulls back behind a line on a map. Yeah, good question though.
Yeah, let's hope it's sooner rather than later. I mean, it's horrendous seeing any of these conflicts, and there's, you know, so many at the moment. So for people listening then, and if they are looking for training, which I absolutely will be, I'm still a white belt with any sort of firearm at the moment. What training do you offer at Red 8?
So we will kind of bespoke tailor everything from somebody who just wants a day, you know, if you or a couple of hours on a range, never shot before, nothing, just wants an experience, all the way up to kind of tier one soft, that want close quarter battle, room clearance and everything kind of refined. We can kind of tailor or tether any course to anybody that wants kind of any level of training.
Brilliant. And where can people find Red 8 on social media and on the website?
For the social media, I think we are on Instagram, and we also have a website. So they're both, one is the Red 8 team, that's on Instagram, and I think the website is, I am not sure.
No problem. I'm going to put the website on the show notes for this episode anyway, so people will be able to find it there. Well, Sean, I want to say thank you so much. I want to be mindful of your time because, as you mentioned, you might literally be jumping on a plane tomorrow to go and get your medal and see some of the people that you serve with. But it's been an incredible conversation. It really has. And, you know, from some of the attributes that led to your success, some of the heroism that, you know, your fellow brothers exhibited that we don't have here anymore, it's been an essential conversation. And then obviously the perspective into Ukraine, which I think most people just don't hear that kind of storytelling at the moment. So I want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
No worries, mate. Look, thanks very much for asking me.